Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I'm Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamond.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you, Rob?
I'm really happy because we are not in the studio today.
Where are we, Rob?
We're in the sun-drenched, sun-filled gallery of the Royal Academy.
Ooh, very posh.
Very posh.
How come we ended up here, Rob?
Because you and I bonded in our beginning of our friendship over a particular artist's work.
Yes.
And we are so excited to be able to speak with her today.
Yes.
She currently has an incredible solo exhibition in the Royal Academy of the Arts, which is in central London. And I recommend everybody to come and see this show. It's on for a bit longer and it's really incredible.
What's it called, Rob?
It's called Cul-de-Sac.
Heaven. And we're here today at the Cul-de-Sac Show with the most incredible artist. Please, can we welcome to Talk Art,
Phyllida DiBarlo.
How are you, Phyllida?
Very well. And it's lovely to be here with you. Really is.
It's such an honour to have you on. Do you know how we bonded over your work? Has Rob told you the story before?
No.
So, Rob?
So, Russell and I were collecting art and we were always looking for, like, new things to collect, but also just to learn. And we heard about your show at the Russian Club, which was with Jesse Flood Paddock.
That's
and it was a duo show. And we also liked Jesse's work. Mm. And then Joe Scotland started telling us about you and about the history of your work.
And Joe Scotland is a director of the Studio Voltaire gallery.
Yeah, and also Sarah McCrory was there back then, I think. And they were really buzzed up about your work and showing your work, and then they offered you an exhibition. And I remember going before you had your exhibition, and they had some little sculptures of yours in the office. And I sent pictures to Russell and was like, this artist is like our new favorite artist, like I'm so excited. And I ended up collecting one of those works from them as it was like a fundraising thing. I think you gave some sculptures to them. And then we found out the Russian Club had like an edition by you where each of the concrete sculptures was like £100 or something. So Russell and I ran down there and we ended up buying about half the edition between us because we literally spent about four.
And I bought them as gifts for people.
Exactly, and we bought them for gifts for people and we decided that we were going to try and split all 30 of the edition to all our friends. And we ended up like selling the edition out to everyone that we knew. So it was hilarious. So we know where they all are. So one day they can come back. But anyway, we like properly bonded over you and then we got really obsessed with your drawings. And even your show you did in Swiss Cottage many, many years ago. Russell bought a drawing from that show, but it was like later.
I bought a drawing from the Swiss Cottage Library. You had a drawing in that show. Yeah, not at the time, later on. I got that from Carsten Schubert.
And I was living in Swiss Cottage at the time, and they were all these funny.
And I got the drawings, you donated drawings to Studio Voltaire, the House of Voltaire show. So I got a couple of drawings from there. So it was really like, as collectors, we came into your work on a collective level.
We learned so much about you because of the word scrim. And like cement and all these unusual like ingredients that go into your work. And it was so exciting.
Yeah, the narrative of your work with these words. Yeah. So anyway, we're here today. So it's a 360 for us to be doing this podcast and be back with you. So we've entered the first room, which is called the Gabriella Jungels Winkler Gallery. Wing, right? Is that right? Guess so. So and we're in your show, The Cul-de-Sac. The first thing we see is concrete plinths that have these painted flags that's made out of like canvas, is it?
Cotton duck canvas.
Wow.
And then they are unrolled, the canvas is unrolled on the studio floor and we paint them with brooms. So big tubs of paint that I just then use brooms to paint the canvas. So the canvas is absolutely drenched with this colour.
Wow.
And then they take about a week to dry. And
how do you dry them? Hanging up? Or?
Yes, over a sort of build a special kind of trestle in the studio to dry them. And it's this all happened in winter, so I was quite worried that they were going to start to get mould on them, which has happened with this technique.
This process before,
hasn't yes, it? Yeah. It takes so long for them to dry that they start to gather all kinds of...
bacteria.
Yes, exactly.
And these works are huge. I mean, so huge. How tall are they? Do you know?
The tallest one is 5.5 metres down to 3.5 metres.
Amazing. Yeah.
So but
what is so bizarre about this whole relationship with materials and getting materials to perform in a way is that it seems quite simple, just the idea of draping canvas like that. But the weight of the canvas is absolutely phenomenal. And it takes each of these concrete cement bases is about 25, about 50 kilograms or more. 75 kilograms. So these, in order to hang the canvas, you need this enormous weight. And I find these things absolutely fascinating.
So is this a trial and error?
Absolutely trial and error. So we had them draped in the studio and they kept on falling over.
Oh, wow.
Until we could get the weight right. And then we had to cast, you know, however many it was of these.
Did you make these all at the same sort of time?
Yes.
So how big is your studio?
It's the one I've got at the moment that's just coming to an end in July is 11,000 square foot.
Whoa.
But I can't afford it. It's just bankrupting me.
Is it really?
This is a real sign of London at the moment.
Yes.
And artists trying to find spaces. But I found a new one, a new studio in South London. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Are you excited about that?
Yes, very, actually. I think it will be. It's much cheaper and all sorts of things.
How long have you been at this studio that's coming to an end?
Since 2014, yeah.
Wow. So you've made your most, like, iconic works in there so far, right?
Like, yeah, I've done a lot of work, yes, in there, yeah. But I'm glad to be leaving it.
You are?
Because, yes, it's just too...
Yeah, sometimes it's good to change, isn't it?
Energy.
And to have a new start somewhere.
Because it's not with a studio provider, the business rates, I mean, it just the amount each month I have to find...
Yeah, it goes up and up and up.
Yes.
Yeah, it's just crazy.
It's really...
Does that ever affect the work in some ways for you?
No, I think it's... Because for years I just had a tiny studio.
Mm.
And I think it's still quite new. It's 8 years that I've had big studios to make work in. So it's like a sort of incentive, you know. Mm. I always feel that things are going to end. Tomorrow, you know, we'll be back to, you know, a domestic studio. Mm. And that was that, you know.
That period was over. But what's the square footage of your new space?
It's 5,000, 6,000 square foot.
Right.
It's
half, huge, though. Half. I mean, that
yes, it is. Compared with what...
Yeah. So going back to this particular work...
Mm. What's the title of this one? Sorry.
It's got some...
Untitled Burrow. Is it that one? Three?
No, those are the wall pieces. Lintel Shadow... Canvas Racks.
Got it, Canvas Racks.
Really
Canvas
racks. Imaginative title, I hope you know.
So when you look at this work, this really brings up this idea that I've always thought about with your body of work, is this idea of the plinth somehow. Mm. And I know these aren't necessarily meant to be plinths, but they could be, you know, they visually look like the shape of a plinth you might sometimes see a sculpture on.
Mm.
And I've always felt with your work, it's almost like, I don't know if it's anti the plinth, but somehow it's like breaking free of that tradition.
Mm, conformity,
and
yeah.
It's quite a prison, I think, for some sculptors, this idea of having to make a sculpture and then put it on a plinth and how you make that look interesting.
Mm.
And obviously some people have made it part of their work, that investigation of like how to make the plinth interesting or something.
Yeah.
But it can just be such a bore, the plinth. And I love that freedom in your work, the way you've kind of got away from that. How do you feel about the plinth?
Well, with the smaller works, I make these bespoke plinths that are actually all part of the work, and are often a result of how the small works get stacked up in the studio.
Yeah.
So it might be on a stack of boxes or a shelf, or I find a very high table. You know, I like viewing work at eye level and slightly above, so the plinths are often quite high, but they're an integral part of the small work.
Yeah, exactly.
And then for me, making the work in the studio is very sort of private and intimate, and I never think about the audience. You know, they just don't exist at all. And then
wow.
The work gets ready to be brought to the venue, and it's a shock because it's as if I've... Who made this stuff, for God's sake?
You know? Did you go into a sort of trance-like state when you make the work?
I'm just so busy with it.
Yeah.
And it's like a relationship. It's like the worst relationship and the best relationship.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a love affair. And then that comes to an end, and it's moved to a space like this.
Mm.
And it's like, my God, you know, who the hell made that stuff? You
yeah,
know?
Yeah. Do you have it in your mind's eye what the work will look like at the end? I mean,
yes.
Something like this, I guess...
And we
you
try
set up the process,
out,
and
when I say we, myself, my studio manager, Adam,
yeah.
And a couple of assistants will try this work out.
Right, right, right.
And then, but I never, very rarely see the whole work...
Visually in your mind.
In, up and finished in the studio.
Oh,
it's
right.
Only when we get to the venues is the opportunity to actually see it finished. So it's a shock, and it's relearning what it is. So then it's, the relationship starts to develop, it's... the work and the space.
Yes.
So there are then two protagonists.
Yes.
And then I finish with that, and that's quite a tense experience installing.
Wow.
But a thrilling experience because it's reacquainting myself with the work. And then the third protagonist, of course, is the audience.
Yeah.
And so for me, the plinth is transformed into an actual space, which in some ways I see as a sort of stage space. And it'd be interesting to get your views.
It's very theatrical. It's immersive. I'm looking at this one above us now. Mm. I want to climb on the top and give a speech.
Yes.
It's like these things. It's kind of frustratingly interactive. It's like I
without
want to be without being interactive.
Yeah,
you can't
that's
climb
a really
over
good
it.
But way of putting
you want,
it. Yeah.
They're like playgrounds, like adult playgrounds in some ways.
Yeah.
They seem too dangerous for kids to go on. But as an adult, you could take the risk, but you're not allowed. It's amazing.
But I love that idea that something's making you want to.
Yeah, I want to run amongst
do
them.
Do something,
and, yeah.
But you can't. So your imagination has to
exactly
then think. Well, what is it? Like
up there.
Up
what
there.
Is it like up there looking down at us or laying there in the sunshine, this platform above us?
And it's so high up, this one as well. It's like almost touching the ceiling.
Yes,
you've kind of like gone as far as you can into the space.
Exactly.
And I always like that kind of that sense of it. I know this might sound a bit dramatic on my part, but like impending doom almost, because that's such a huge block of concrete up there.
Mm.
And at any minute it might sort of fall down. There's some kind of precarious, I don't know.
And I think I think that's really interesting what you said about doom, because I'm quite I'm quite interested in these opposites, that something can be doom laden but also maybe thrilling or have other qualities as well. So it's playing with two different sort of emotions in a way, and I think to me, the use of height and the use of precariousness is a kind of metaphor of, you know, how we all live, you know, on our nerves, etc., or even in relationship to the world around.
And I remember your incredible installation you did a few years ago at the Tate Britain.
Oh, yes.
Which was in the Devine Galleries.
Mm.
And in my opinion, it's one of the greatest Devine Gallery commissions, because you took on that space and made me look at pieces of that building, even not even just your own work, but you kind of transformed that building. I'd never even seen corners of that building that I discovered through your work.
Oh, great.
And when you walked through that, it was this huge kind of hallway of, you know, like crazy kind of sculpture. I don't know what you call it, like a...
Like a climbing frame.
Like a climbing frame,
like
almost. Yeah, exactly.
Like
this
adventure
huge
playground,
frame,
but like closed off.
And it was one of the most powerful experiences I've ever had in that space.
Mm.
And how did that one come about?
Well, oddly enough, it began with something that was, in a way, the complete opposite to what I do. I think one of the best installations I've seen there was Martin Creed's Runners.
Loved that.
And I just think that use, where the space was vacated, mm-hmm. apart from this pounding noise that was like a heartbeat, and there was a great sense of threat about that.
There was doom about that, yeah, because you're like, why are people running? If you're in a public arena and people start running, then there's obviously like, what are they running from? And the current climate, terrorism, that's the first thing that runs
into
your mind.
We met him the other week and we spoke about that. Mm. And I said, when I saw it, I was like, who are these people? What are they? I didn't realise. You know, it was fascinating.
So I began to think about that space, and then I went and sat outside the Tate and looked at the river outside. And it was very formal. The river runs like the top of a T, and the Tate Britain is like the bottom of the T. It's like a T shape. That sounds really funny.
No.
But these barges going down with just these big crates. And I thought that's the emptiness, and then maybe nothing should touch the ground in there. So I started to think about just hanging things just above head level and at body level throughout the Davine, apart from one collapsed piece in it. And so it was like a combination of Martin Creed's work opening up a way of thinking about that space, and sitting and just looking at the river passing by in a way triggered what I wanted to do with that space, to create this sense of suspense, both literally suspending things and as if everything was frozen in a particular moment there. And I suppose that's what I love about sculpture. It is dumb and silent, and it doesn't get up and walk around. You have to do the walking around.
Yeah.
You know? And its passivity makes us active, you know. And I think that's quite counter to what we experience on a daily basis. Which is that everything is flickering and moving, screens are flickering and moving, but sculpture is pointlessly still, silent, dumb, useless. And to me, that's its absolute greatness.
Genius,
you know, that, you know, as an artist, I can actually have a position or permission to make something that is completely counter to the world we're in terms of its physicality, mm-hmm. but can in a way be an expression of the world we're in. So I enjoy that paradox in a way.
Well, I think your work stops you taking for granted what you assume you're going to see in a gallery and what you assume a space is. Like, you would walk into it and you take for granted the wall space and the height, but your work challenges that so much that what Rob was saying, when you suddenly notice areas of the building you're in because of your work. It sort of thrusts you and makes you take stuff in.
Is that what an actor experiences? I'm always in because I'm fascinated by the behind the scenes things of.
You want people to see exposed people to different stories, I guess, to different ways of life, to different ways of thinking, but you also want to hold their hand and let them feel like they are being represented or they recognise that emotion. And your work, you recognise, it just challenges what it is to be in an art gallery, what it is to be in a space, how we've sort of been programmed to exist within a space, I guess. And I guess that is stage acting, I guess, especially does that when the screen goes up and you see the set, it's like, and you see something really challenging, you're like, wow, this is really affecting the environment, the arena.
You
are in the, it feels like you're coming to the arena with your work. Definitely.
You know, I heard an interview with the musician Tori Amos the other day.
Oh, right,
and I think it might have been a really old one, I'm not sure now. I don't know what era it was, but she was talking about when her career became really successful, and she was writing all these very personal songs about rape and about relationships, and, you know, very intense things. At the time, no one was talking about it. It's way before the Me Too movement. It was like 91 or something.
Yeah.
And she said she quickly realized that going on stage and singing those songs was no longer just about her experience or her. It was about all the people in the audience, and it was all their stories and all their own, you know, personal traumas or whatever. And she quickly realized the responsibility of that somehow, to let them experience their own own and go through their own stories and work it all out for themselves.
Their projection.
And that's what I also think actors can do. You know, because I watched someone on the tube this morning when I came here watching a TV show on his iPhone, because the world's just changed so much now. We can watch TV on the train. And he was so engrossed, and you could see this passion and this kind of like, he was so excited by it. And I love that idea that you can somehow work out your own experiences and troubles, but you work it out through different mediums of art or film or music or whatever.
Was he attractive, Rob?
Powerful. No, he wasn't
attractive. Yes, sure. Like, I was really watching this man watching
Russell,
TV.
That's not fair.
Let's move on.
So these wall works here, there are two sculptures which are very kind of bulbous, lumpy, kind of strange, unusual, almost brain-like.
Scrim.
Scrim. Is there scrim in there?
There is scrim in there.
We love scrim.
Did you make the word scrim up? Or is scrim?
It's as old as the hills. I mean, Donatello used scrim.
Really? That's so cool.
If it was very unique to you, though, scrim.
Really?
Yeah, oh, for no, us it I mean, does.
It's a hugely traditional material that you use to give support to liquid materials like plaster and cement. So you dip the scrim into those materials.
What exactly is scrim?
It's a jute. It's a Hessian woven...
I know exactly what it is.
Like plaster of Paris that you put over broken
Exactly,
arms,
but this is a very broad weave scrim, so it's quite...
Which you often see in your work, actually, but I never knew that was the actual scrim. Now we know.
Yes. It's just there with that bit of pink on it. Yeah.
Wow. So these two works have got rid of the plinth completely, and they're now wall-based. And
yes, which is a kind of plinth. I mean, it's quite... I think what I was trying to say about the stage, in a way, the stage becomes a plinth, you know. So to me, these are... In a way, this whole space is a kind of all-embracing plinth, you know.
Yeah.
So it's... And here, I think the wall is very much the plinth that articulates the space around these objects.
If that makes any sense. These works in particular, they're much smaller in scale. So are these, I always sort of almost imagine you sort of making these somehow, like with your hands.
They're very direct,
aren't they?
The smaller works are, in a way, the engine of all the works. You know, the bigger works come out of where I make the smaller works because I can still make them all myself. But the bigger works, I do need a team of people to do them. I can't do them myself. Yeah. So these are very, very close to me physically. I sometimes feel that I'm making them almost in a state of blindness. They're not necessarily about a visual image that's in my head. They're about a process of actions, of burrowing, of pulling, of removing, you know, and eventually an object emerges from that.
Oh, I love that.
How do you know when it's...
Very good question. I don't.
And so would you look at that now and think, still could do a bit more on that?
Yes, there's a restlessness. And I that's another thing I love about sculpture, is I think it's in the way I work, it's purposefully courting a kind of unsettledness. It's battling with the way materials want to settle. They want to set, or they want to be fixed in some way. And I'm quite interested in their restlessness and the fact that maybe they fall over, they burst, they don't stick, they're difficult to fix, and exploring those qualities. And not just as a visual experience, but as a very tactile, sentient experience.
Wow. You know? And I love that idea of making, and you're not really sure what it is you're about to make.
Very much that's why for me the smaller ones are so important.
Yeah, you know? But I think that's such an important thing to tell people now, because the younger artists that I meet these days, they're often so paralyzed by the idea that you have to have great thought and great intellectual kind of ideas.
Apparatus.
Yes,
yeah.
But before you've made the work, and the work has to somehow embody all of that weight of intelligence or something, where actually I think people are forgetting just to make and actually put your hands on clay or put your hand on the paint or you know, the paintbrush or whatever, and just try and make and then discover through that process.
Yeah, I think it's very difficult. And I think artists who work in this exploratory way, where they're not sure where the end is or the finish is, are also quite vulnerable, actually, because I think these works are kind of extensions of their own bodies and their own mental apparatus. And for me, they don't have an idea. They're idealless. So they can seem stupid,
right, and dumb.
And I think critically, they then become very difficult to write about. And it's how maybe artists who are working in that way can stand up and articulate something about that process that's quite important. Talking about responsibility, you know, of Tori Amos, I thought that was brilliant what you said, you know, that maybe there is, you know, for me, there is an act of communication that is verbal, that isn't the work, but can give some insight into what the sensual experience of making is, and that it isn't a verbal experience. It's some other kind of experience. And I think that's, for me, very important.
Great. And I remember when we first discovered your work, it was this kind of scale of work that we first saw. And I remember having this very almost involuntary connection to it that was very much about almost like the soul somehow. And I could feel like not just your soul, but like my own somehow in these works. And I found them so incredibly inspiring, I think, because of that experience. And it was interesting because at the time I'd not seen work like this that much in younger artists or contemporary art in London. And I mean, there were references that I didn't initially think of, things like Franz West or different people.
Yeah.
But equally, it was different, and it was very other to me.
Mm.
And it wasn't like even referencing those people. It felt new and exciting. But it's quite interesting how you weren't necessarily embraced by the commercial art world until much later.
Mm.
And I was wondering whether you think that is just about timing, or whether it has something to do with like being a woman, or what you think that is.
I think what's fantastic due to people like you, and is that we're in actually, despite everything, there's a lot to talk about art now, but there's an incredible openness about art now. You know, and people. Artists themselves, you know, that kind of modernist rigor, you know, it's imploded. We've had enough of it, you know. We've had enough of having, you know, being told what's good and what's bad and what's right and what's wrong, you know, which I think that modernist trajectory was something that I experienced as a young artist, you know. And it was strange to be always in the wrong, you know.
Right.
And whether that was a female thing, or whether it was that my interests were just diversifying away from that very strict lineage where you go from Picasso to conceptual art in a sort of straight line.
Yes, yes.
And nobody thinks like that now. It's crazy to think about now. You know, you're thinking of artists from Korea, China, India, all over the place. So it's that ridiculous, rigorous kind of art history, art history has, you know, it's withered on the vine. And therefore, I think possibly my trajectory didn't fit into that particular white male history.
Right.
And so when things did start to open up, through people like yourself and other younger galleries, you know, I think I had a new audience in a way, and which was in my favour.
we met Janet Street Porter last night, and we were talking about this idea about how the kind of rules have been broken down, and that now art can be anything, and that it doesn't, you know, if you're making a pot, for example, that can be just as valued and revered as, you know, a fine artwork or whatever, and the craft is somehow, you know, there is an art in craft or something. And I wonder if timing-wise, because of, like, the internet and all of that development, and we were all starting to communicate in such a different way, to have work like yours, which is so physical and so kind of, you can feel you in this work somehow.
It's quite performative, your work.
Yeah. Well, yes, again, I think, yeah. But I think I think it is a very exciting time. I mean, the performance of making does interest me.
Have you ever filmed yourself making it?
No, but they've got a film here. Of,
oh, really?
Yes, yeah. No, it's absolutely excruciating. I wish I'd said, could they please do cosmetic surgery? Because there seems to be a huge emphasis on my triple chins.
Oh. I think you've got a glorious chin standing next to you.
But I'd love to show you the other small works in there.
Yeah,
I say there's a lot of colour. I mean, the colour features in your work, and I would say that pink is one of your favourite colours.
Yes, it's because I think it's an in-between colour. It's not...
red.
It's not red, and it's not whatever, you know, it's sort of slightly... And it's a wonderful colour in the urban environment. If you look at the way they mark pavements to be repaired, they're often sprayed.
Oh, with a fluoro pink, aren't
yes,
they?
Yes,
you're right.
And the end of scaffolding poles can be painted pink so you don't walk into them. So these
that's
sort
the thing
of,
about your work is that you notice things exactly. like that because of you. That's what we're saying. Like you notice on the street, we walk along, go, it looks like Phil de Barlow.
One of the bricks that we got from the Russian club, Russell gave me for my birthday, and then I gave him one. So we both, it was kind of a ridiculous gift.
I'm
so
amazed.
We gave one to each other. But the one that he gave me has a pink cross on it.
Yes.
And it's very small. And then I said to him after he gave me that, I was like, every time I walk on the street now, I keep seeing like a yellow mark or a pink mark, and it just reminds me of Phil de Barlow. Yeah. And it is, that's what great artists do. I think you reflect the world around you,
yeah,
and often it can be a social thing, yeah, but I love the fact that you're actually sort of taking from the everyday and that it somehow transforms our everyday experience.
Yeah,
it kind of
totally.
Makes my walk to work or whatever more enjoyable somehow. Yeah. It's kind of an interesting thing.
But you're very generous, both of you, and that's amazing to experience as an artist, your generosity. It's just fantastic.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
But I think the less colour in this show is very much a result of the Venice experience. Mm. Because in Venice with the British Pavilion, I crammed it to the gills. So in a way, if I'm interested in a relationship between space and object, it's also a kind of feud. Does the space devour the object or the object devour the space? And I really wanted to go for that in Venice, in a way, to a kind of extreme. So the viewer was sort of almost squashed to the edges. And I think there was a lot of metaphor then, because I'm not saying the subject was Brexit. In no way was it the Brexit. But using the British Pavilion as a sort of performative space for sculpture, which is still and silent and dumb, it was a really, for me, a huge challenge to know where the audience fitted in to that and to have the work bursting out of it, which I did with these big baubles that were all across the front of the British Pavilion.
Were you happy with the show?
I was difficult to answer, because when I left Venice after that opening week, something was perplexing me and I couldn't put my finger on what it was. Just briefly, I won't bore you, was that the German pavilion was just unbelievable, where you walked on these glass tables and there were dogs underneath and perform naked bodies. It was just, and the audience, I was looking at the audience and they were just still, silent and mesmerized. And then the Canadian pavilion, you had these water shoots. This is the 2017 Venice Biennale.
Biennale, yeah.
And then the French Pavilion, it was this sound studio. And I thought, it's so interesting. The audience, in a way, can just wait for the work to come to them. But with my work, you have to, as an audience, you have to activate
it.
Activate it. And this passive-active thing started to really obsess me. Mm-hmm. And I actually got a kind of revulsion to my Venice work.
Wow.
And it was very, very strong. And I just wanted to hone the work down to its bare essentials, and in a way that meant rethinking the colour and the application of colour, and also examining the idea of the autonomous object, the object that can just stand by itself and perform by itself, and then the space for the viewer and the audience to activate it. So the relationship with the space is in a way almost allowing the space to win, which I think is what this show is about. Whereas Venice, it was definitely trying to conquer, you know, make the space be devoured by the work.
But this is so fascinating, because you were saying earlier that when you make sculptures in the studio, you're not thinking about the audience yet, or even about the presentation, maybe so much in the sense of an exhibition. But then I read a reviewer wrote about you once that they saw it almost like you were a marionette, like the people were like puppets within, as an audience member, that it was somehow you're really controlling the environment and controlling the experience.
How they experienced it.
Exactly. No, manipulation was actually a word that got used, and I was a bit shocked when I heard that I don't know if it's a podcast or an article I read. But in this exhibition, it's called Cul-de-sac. Mm. And as you walk through, you have no choice at the end, because it's a dead end.
Yeah.
And then you have to walk back.
Exactly,
So you are very much controlling, in a sense, the audience's experience.
That's why I call the audience the third protagonist.
Right.
Because I see them as performers in relationship to the work and the space, you know, and hope that the way they use their bodies is exploratory, you know, that they are imagining the height of. I mean, this is the ideal viewer, of course.
Right.
I can't guarantee, but I think there probably is a degree of manipulation. Yes, I'm very conscious of how active an audience potentially can be, and that excites me a lot in the sense of being able to give the audience something. That it's not just standing still, then that's it. You know,
you have to work your way around.
Yes.
You have to move, yeah.
And you also have to look in every corner of the space. I mean, even now, I'm looking through this archway. That's what I love about this exhibition, is the fact you get views into different rooms.
Yes.
So from this, we're now in the middle room of the exhibition. There are three rooms. And if you look up there, you see the dots of colour on the wood, on those planks of wood.
Yes, I hadn't
even noticed those when we were in the room.
Because I was looking at...
Did you?
Yeah.
But I was looking at the concrete surface and thinking about the feeling of that material, you know, how it's dried or something. But now I'm looking in there and I see a different thing again. Mm-hmm. So it is great that.
Mm. How aware are you of where your work is placed? What collector-wise?
Hugely. Collector.
Like collector-wise and museum-wise?
I have no idea where it is, and I'm always sort of dreading the phone call that says, a bit has fallen off the work. What shall we do? You know,
yes, of course.
Because of the way they're made, they're not necessarily terrifically stable, you know, and that's something I'm continuously working on, is trying to
stabilize.
But
have you made many visits to collections?
No, I haven't. No, but they might come back, I have to send. Or there's a dreaded envelope is sent with the little pieces.
Right. How do you feel about that, though? The feeling that for the rest of your life you've got to be like having to amend broken pieces of sculpture.
Slightly panic stricken. Yes.
But also, I felt like you were interested in, because in your early work, you were doing a lot of regional exhibitions, and you were also teaching for about 40 years.
Yes.
And one of the part of the story that I kind of loved was this idea that you would make a sculpture, say this one here, this giant sculpture here that we're standing in front of, and then at the end of the exhibition, because it wasn't getting bought, because it was too big, I guess, for most people to even put in their house or whatever, you would then take that the remnants of that work and then put it into a new work almost recycle and keep moving it into new works.
All the the upright, so they're all from the Tate show.
Oh, really?
Yes, and in there as well.
Yeah, so it's almost like
everything's constantly.
Some of the work just doesn't exist anymore that we're seeing in documented.
Yes, yeah, a lot of the work doesn't exist. In fact, we're sort of deciding which of these will be stored,
recycled,
yeah. And then if they are remade again, some of them can be very easily remade again, so there's not much point in keeping.
Right. Well, so you're okay with, say this one in front of us now, well, not this one, but say this one that's like the three tyres and tops,
yes.
And say you took that part and that became other work, and someone came to you and went, I want you to recreate the cylindrical three tyre work. Would you be reluctant to do that?
Or? Yes, I would, I think, because I think it would be a real,
repetition.
Well, it would be financially just crazy, so maybe this one will be hung on to for a few years and see whether it can go somewhere,
Where would it be hung? Have you got storage or is that the galleries?
Gallery, got very it. Kindly.
And that's actually the great thing of working with Hauser & Werther is they have the budget to really help.
Oh, they're incredible.
Support what you're doing and also protect what you've made and things like that.
Yeah.
But I was really into that idea of when you're recycling, that somehow the energy is moved from one sculpture to another.
Well, I can show you on the pieces at the end.
Yeah.
So we're now moving through.
I love
to
this one.
This is like
Battlestar Galactica or the Star Wars ship. Yes. It makes me think of this one. Millennium Falcon, this looks like.
Have you seen the photograph of Harry Hill in front of this?
No.
He stands with his head framed by the black shape.
He's great. He's so intelligent, Harry Hill. He really loves art. I think he makes art himself and he collects art.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and he's really, really passionate about it.
Oh, right.
I think he's great. Yes. Is this polystyrene in this work?
The big tower, the big
That's
barrel.
That's polystyrene.
Yes.
Wow. And what about these sticks here?
They're plaster over timber. And amazing. That's recycled timber,
And you can see each screw as well, can't you? It's
yes.
Amazing.
But I think fakery is also very, going back to theatricality, I think, making, that's polystyrene, but it's masquerading as
a beam, like
something,
a wooden beam.
Yes, yeah.
So it's the trickery of what you assume, assumptions.
I enjoy that, and interested in it and interested in playing between what do we consider to be real and what do we consider to be false? Uh-huh. Why is a computer screen with something on it sort of hierarchically less real than sitting on the chair opposite the guy with the screen? What is our perception of realities,
right,
especially when it comes to physical stuff like this, and then are the many realities, the fact that the big barrels look possibly like cement or wall of some sort, but they're not.
And also the weight of it in real life must actually be quite light compared to what you'd think it would be.
What it might be, And in fact, they're really heavy. So there's that, the sort of parody in a way, and I find that it's like the bronze,
It's hollow inside.
Yes, exactly. Big black hollow inside, and yet
It looks so
it's
strong,
seen
it,
as though it's the sort of height of sculptural achievement, which it may well be, but it's not what it sort of aspires to be, which is a big solid object. It's just a shell, one centimetre thick.
So we're now entering the third room of the exhibition, which, again, this is such a great time of day to come because we're here in the morning and the light is incredible.
Absolutely
in this gallery.
Wonderful, isn't it? It's just so slightly eerie, isn't it, in a way?
You're an RA.
Yes.
When did you become an RA officially?
In 2011,
And what did that feel like?
Well, a sort of huge honour, but full of mysterious feelings as well. Sort of, I think, that childishness of wanting to be sort of a bit rebellious, suddenly it's the establishment, you've stepped across the great divide, and it's quite a real emotion that, it's almost as though you're leaving one tribe behind and joining
the next
tribe, yes.
But you still feel like you've got your foot in both tribes,
I do, yes.
But also, how important is it, though, to have people from, you know, different tribes or something.
Exactly.
Yes, and without that connection, change doesn't happen.
Yes.
So it's really important. When you are made an RA, I actually think it's really significant and important. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, and it shouldn't be taken lightly either. Or,
no.
Because also people can be so snobby about it as well and be like, oh, I don't want to be an RA. Or,
no.
Or, and you're also a CBE. And some people turn down that honour. But then sometimes it's important to be part of those things because that's how you change the world in a way.
Exactly, right?
When was you made CBE?
Was it 2 years ago?
When that was for services to the arts?
Yes, and I made Prince Charles laugh, which I think is my high spot.
How?
You go up and he has what's called a mutterer, and they are sort of telling him who the people are and what it's for. And he said, I believe you make sculpture. And I said, yes, I do. And he said, what kind of sculpture? And I said, well, I'm really sorry, but it's the ugly kind. And he just laughed and he said, well, do you ever make the beautiful kind? And I said, well, I would for you, you know. And it was just a sort of nice moment amongst this kind of very ceremony. Yeah. But what was so incredibly moving about that was that I was in a queue with a wonderful woman who was something called British rowing. And what she was doing was cleaning canals, cleaning waterways, so that people could use the waterways, you know, for all sorts of activities. Mm-hmm. And then the guy in front of me, I said what he was, and he says, oh, give me a Harrier jet and I'll take it apart and put it back together again.
Wow.
And I don't know, there's something really remarkable about what people do in their lives, you know, that it's not just
how you'll randomly come together
in
that line.
Exactly. And I love that. I love that kind of sense that, you know, so many different people can
There's no order to it, really.
Yeah,
it makes you
absolutely, yeah. It's like those brilliant conversations you can have on a straight train platform and you never meet the person again.
But you give so much away.
Yes, sometimes. Exactly, yes.
You just described your work as the ugly kind. Do you obviously must find beauty in it, but do you really think your work is ugly, parenthesis?
I think I'm attracted to the kind of underbelly of the world around, you know, the things that are not conventionally beautiful, and trying to maybe bring some beauty to those things. I mean, I find the way those blocks are balanced on those, I just find that immensely
satisfying.
Yes,
yeah, me too.
Exactly. And there's a sort of feeling that they're about to move, you know.
Yeah, they are going to slip down.
Yes, yeah.
So the urban jungle is like your dreamscape,
yes,
really.
Yes, and in a way the rural as well, because I think you get these incidents, sort of ambiguous incidents in the rural environment. Like suddenly there's a sort of concrete patch in the middle of a field, and it's obviously where the tractors park or something, and I like that collision of human-made activities, you know, the ploughed field, the concrete patch, the trimmed hedges, or the
quite dystopian sort of.
Yes, in a way it is that sort of control, and where the controls break down. Yes, it is dystopian.
Yeah,
that's a good way of
the thing. I think I love about it as well is that this may not be beautiful in a sense that everyone's been taught to believe is beautiful. Mm. But to me, I've always thought it was quite beautiful work. And like these sculptures here, I find it all really beautiful.
Yes.
And the way that drapery there, you know, is it covered in concrete there?
Not, yes, yeah. that's scrim.
Scrim. Oh, that's scrim.
Scrim. That's
yay. Really. But the way that drapes, like, I find it incredibly poetic, actually.
Look at the balance of this
and,
one.
Yeah. Rob, and if we're going to walk around now. But the other thing I've always loved about your work are the titles of the exhibitions, and then often the titles of the work, which sometimes are quite descriptive in a way.
Yes.
But the actual titles of the exhibitions, like even this one, Cul-de-sac, they mean they're quite poetic. They're almost like concrete poetry or something, or like
interesting.
And is literature a big influence in your
Rig
life?
Rig was one that stuck out for me. That was one of your shows. It's very human made.
Yes, I like this one. Isn't, but I like verbs that are also nouns. So the rig around a ship, say, but also to rig something up. other titles often play with that noun, verb thing. Yeah. But this was made in situ, or these and the...
In the space?
Yes, yeah. Oh, wow. So we had the floor covered and we were dipping these long rolls of scrim into cement and then flicking them onto the posts. So the top section stood on the ground so we could reach it. And that was great. What did it take? An hour, you know?
Really?
Time is quite important to me.
Well, your team must be on your wavelength completely. You must be like, right, guys, this is what we're doing. Bear with me. And
yes.
They must be like, okay, we're on it.
Yes.
Fill it up, right.
Yeah.
CBE, all right.
No, they don't
we're
say
on
we're
it.
On it. They
oh.
stay very silent. I'm thinking, are they okay? Are they going to walk out on me?
Yeah. That's amazing.
I know, they're incredible. And, you know, it's a tough call sometimes, like installing this show. And so it's very important to respect that, you know, mm-hmm. what they do.
Mm-hmm. I came to your house recently in Finsbury Park.
Mm.
I didn't actually see you that day,
no.
but I saw your family.
Yeah.
And I noticed in the house there were lots of drawings and notes and, like, it's not just you, it's also your husband,
yes.
who's a great artist and mm. writer as well.
Yes,
yeah.
yes.
And there were notes all over the house and mm. different objects, and I kept seeing so much of both of your work throughout the house.
Yeah.
So how important is drawing to you?
Huge, huge. And I have hundreds of sketchbooks that I leave around the house, so there's always one to hand. And then I do these, what I call coloured drawings. Really, I just try and keep that going because it's a form of contemplation. And I love this way. Sometimes there can be quite a vivid image, but more often there isn't. So it's this, again, being in this state where there isn't that thing called an idea, but there may be a very strong sensation which I want to attach to something that is an image, like the idea of throwing the scrim at a structure and seeing how it lands, and then making drawings of that. And gradually this kind of information builds up, which is a real clue to what I want to then do next.
Right.
So a lot of the drawings would come to fruition into sculpture.
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
Right.
Yeah. And I draw this at the beginning when I'm not quite sure what it is, and I draw it in the middle of its process, and then at the end. So sometimes works have quite a big back archive, if you know
wow.
what I
so
mean.
So every sculpture you consider preparatory sketches for it?
Not
really.
Everyone, but
right.
but many of them do have
wow.
a whole sort of library.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's very much part of you working out your thought processes. And
yes,
the
yes,
of, yes,
exactly. I mean, in a way, it's incredibly traditional. You know, there are small models, there are drawings, then there are the big ones, or there are just the small ones, which I'm only just now beginning to make drawings about,
oh, really? Oh.
which I'm really enjoying because there's a sort of echo, if you know what I mean, that gets down onto the paper, and it's the colour and everything can be very free.
Right. Mm. Another thing, you described us as being generous earlier, but I've always, every time I've met you, I've always felt you have a huge amount of kind of empathy and generosity in your spirit.
Mm.
And I wonder if that's also because you spent so long teaching other people. And all the people that a lot of young artists I know were taught by you,
mm.
and they all sing your praises and,
oh, really?
and also talk about how much you challenged them and
mm.
actually made them think differently about
oh.
what they were doing.
Mm.
And you were quite provoking in a way. I think you it wasn't like just a passive, you know,
mm.
Relationship somehow. You were very much pushing people mm. and making them think more about how they made their work.
Mm.
And it's lasted that impact. So what was teaching like for you, and how important is that whole legacy to
you? I think the working with young artists is an enormous privilege. And I don't mean that sycophantically.
Yeah.
I just think as an older artist to be in touch with younger artists who are experiencing things. You know, I mean, take the whole computer age. You know, they would have grown up with computers, unlike my generation, which had to sort of scrabble to get some knowledge of this, yeah. you know, and they've grown up with things so that these different timescales that, you know, a teacher of my age, I don't teach anymore, but would have had the experience of, is hugely stimulating and enriching. And then bringing to that maybe the need to inspire confidence and to really inspire somebody's imagination, you know, and all the things that are lurking in that imagination that, that maybe not yet the courage to act upon, and trying to get that. They go for it, you know, forget about being right or wrong or good or bad, you know. Go for what you are thinking about, you know. Respect your thoughts, you know. Don't worry about art. That will look after itself, you know. Right. But you are more important in terms of what's going on in your head, you know.
I think something I found really inspiring as well about what I've read about you in interviews was when you say that because obviously you weren't necessarily being totally accepted by the art world until a lot later, in a way, yes. like being collected and all of that stuff, having big museum shows around the world like you do now. For a long time, I mean, 40 years or something, you were not, I don't think you were ignored, but I think you just weren't in the commercial art world in that sense. Mm. But you were saying that it doesn't matter because in making, you know, it doesn't matter what the end result is, you just need to make.
Yes.
And yeah. I love that idea that the end result even doesn't matter or the reception of it doesn't matter.
No.
But should it mean that if a book doesn't get published, you shouldn't write that book? Or
that's my example, yeah. you know, and if we apply that kind of fascism, we're destroying ourselves. So
exactly.
I suppose during the teaching years, you know, maybe I was a bit of a stuck record, you know, which was, you know, don't just aim for fame and a gallery because it may not happen. And, you know, disappointment is something we've all got to learn to weather and in a way overcome. And that's a huge thing to have to tackle in oneself. So it's much more important to establish how you want to place your internal world into the outside, you know, and be incredibly proud and confident about those processes that help you do that, than always gnawing away at an idea of what success is, you know. Of course, success is important, but it's also a kind of disease in some way, you know, that you have a very fixed idea of what success is, rather than actually just making a piece of work can be
right.
a way you gauge your own success, you know.
Amazing. Well, we ask every guest who comes on two very challenging questions. The first one is, if you could do an art heist, you could steal a work of art, like a touchstone artwork for you anywhere in the world, take it home and live with it, what would that be?
And just before you answer, you don't have to have you don't have to be able to put it in your pocket. You can literally, we will bring trucks.
Will you?
And we will help you.
Loaders,
we'll bring you
cranes.
A crane, anything you want to
yeah,
help you.
Scrim, just bags
just like
bags of scrim to rack it up and get it
work.
Out. Yeah.
Velasquez.
Ooh.
Las Meninas.
Oh,
really?
So that's
yes.
in the Prado, isn't it?
Yes, yes. Yeah. It'd be difficult. How shall we do it?
That's what I'm saying, just cover it with scrim.
I've got connections in Madrid.
Oh, there we go.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, it's all right.
Do we go through the ceiling and pick it up?
Definitely.
Let's go through the floor. Let's be non-conformers. Let's burrow down.
just like in Mission Impossible, we could have, like, Tom Cruise.
Thomas Crown affair.
Oh, yeah, yes, yes.
Yeah, yeah,
very
yes.
dramatic.
That's
yeah,
yours.
Yeah.
It's coming your way.
Thank
so
you. I'm
that.
Really grateful.
And I just want to walk over to this side of the room. We're going to go right to the end of the exhibition now, and we're going to go under the giant blocks of what looked like polystyrene about to...
I came in here and there was a whole group of children, and one of them, the education person was there, and she said, would I talk to them? So I did. It was just and I said, have you got any questions? And one little girl said, yeah, you know, you're very old. How did you live those... I just love children. I just think they get to the heart of things absolutely straight away.
That's so funny.
Yeah, no editing there.
No editing, yes, exactly.
So the other question we ask every guest is, what is your favourite colour?
Which is so tough. Everyone goes so many people get really
Well,
stumped.
The the colour I love using the most is around you, pink. But I think I like street colours, you know, yellows, reds, sort of narcissistic colours that are very visible
Why would they be narcissistic? Because it's overpowering.
Because attention-seeking, you know, like notices, like warning signs or colours that, you know, meant to be...
You can't ignore.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's very interesting in airports, which are my... I go instantly dyslexic and autistic and everything. I can't. But the notices are all yellow. And I always wonder, is that really the wisest colour to have in an airport? You know, I can't... I'm standing underneath departures and I have to ask somebody and say, where is the departures? And the look of sort of, oh, God, we've got one of these in the airport.
You know, is it your first time?
Right there, madam, you know.
What colour would you use then?
I don't know, but I often wonder whether they shouldn't be pink, actually.
Yes. You
know?
Yeah. Well, that would make you very happy.
Yes, very.
Well, this has been... the most incredible experience, Phyllis. Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, it's such an incredible show. Everyone, please come and see it.
How much longer is it on for?
It's on to the end of June, I think.
Oh, fantastic. At the Royal Academy in Piccadilly.
Yeah, it's on to the 23rd of June. And it's right in the centre of London. If you live outside of London, I really recommend travelling up to London and seeing this show.
Same.
Or even flying over here, because I know we have a lot of people listening all over the world now. And look, this is such a beautiful way to end the exhibition, because look, just looking through those rooms, through the archways, you can see your favourite colour, pink.
And we've got to walk back through, because it's a cul-de-sac.
Yes, let's do it.
So that's exciting. Yeah. If you want to see any of the images of today's podcast, please go onto the @TalkArt app, or not app, on Instagram,
app
feed.
Yeah.
And you'll be able to see all of those. And
and you can see more of Phyllida's work at her gallery's website, houserandworth.com.
Yes. Have you got a website yourself?
No, I haven't, actually.
Are you on Instagram?
No, sorry.
You're a tweeter?
No.
Well done, you. She's way too busy. You're not like realising this room is full of so much work.
Yeah. Well, thanks for listening, guys.
Thank you, Phyllida. It's been amazing
to
spend time with you.
Thank you so much.
Lots of love.
It's been wonderful.
And
yeah.
We'll be back soon, guys.
All right, bye.
Bye. You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamant and Russell Tovey. Follow us on Instagram @TalkArt, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in this episode. Recorded at Spiritland London by Anthony Shaw and edited by Gareth Isles. Subscribe to Talk Art on iTunes and Spotify. Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.